No more bullshit. Dig it? No more bullshit.
You want answers?
CliffCentral.com.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
It's a little bit later on a Tuesday than we'd normally start off on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. I'm your host, Silly Charalambos, and I'm joined in studio by my producer, Duncan. Very intimate little two of us here in the studio today. We're going to be talking some of the xenophobic violence that's been happening in Soweto. We've got Greg Nicholson standing on the line for us to give us a first-hand account of what's been happening in Soweto. Greg, you there?
Hi, Stewie. How are you?
All right, Greg. A couple of rough days in Soweto, some unsavory things happening down there. You've been there. You've been on the front lines. Give us the lowdown. What's been happening there?
I think actually we have to go back to, on Monday night last week in Snake Park, Soweto, when what happened there was it actually just started out as quite a sort of innocent incident between the Somali store owner and a boy who everyone says was high on yope. And according to multiple witnesses that spoke to Daily Maverick, this boy is a thief and from one of the spaza shops there. And the Somali store owner actually confronted him and told him to go away because he always steals. The boy wouldn't go away, and then the Somali store owner brought a machete out, and then the boy refused to go away and got quite angry and agitated. And then one of the co-shopkeepers, another Somali national, brought out a gun, and that sort of enraged the community. They you know, already there's a lot of this feeling that, you know, foreigners shouldn't belong there. They're taking South African business and whatnot. And so when these guys saw this community owner with a gun, they thought that wasn't right. And some of them thought the gun might be illegal, or they wondered whether a foreigner can own a gun. And so then what happened there in Snake Park is the community met, and from some of our sources that tell us, they say that some of the community leaders were saying that this isn't okay, that we don't support xenophobia, but sorry, there's just some noise here. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you clearly, Greg.
So what happened then is some of the community leaders said, we don't support xenophobia, but we can't tolerate this sort of stuff happening. And so the action they decided to take then, because the police had arrived and were protecting that store, so the action they decided to take then was to loot the other foreign-owned stores in Snake Park. So they went from this supermarket called the Waka Waka Supermarket down around the corner to another supermarket or spaza shop called the Bafana store. Then they went up about a few hundred meters away to another place, I think, called the Russell Supermarket. And it was at the Russell Supermarket where the store owner there, I think he's a Somali national. He woke up in the night and with people trying to loot his store, sort of scared them off. They came back, and he ended up opening fire with a illegal firearm that the police have now found. And in that process, he killed a 14-year-old local boy. And so really that kick-started this whole thing. Since then we've seen protests or lootings across Soweto.
Greg, but there's obviously an underlying issue here that there is this resentment towards foreigners that has just, I mean, there was an incident that sparked this violence. That underlying sentiment, where does it stem from? What's the origin of this sentiment towards foreigners who are working in places like Soweto?
It's so deep, eh? And there really are a lot of underlying causes. So first of all, I think you're right. We have to ask, this one incident happens where there's, you know, a bit of a confrontation between a store owner and a local resident who everyone says was a thief and a nyope addict. Why does it stem out of control and all of a sudden start looting across Soweto and start complete violence, you know? And I think there's a number of issues. First of all, a lot of people just tell us that they really want these foreigners to go. They're angry with them. And I think part of that is that these people, you know, from Somalia, Ethiopia, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, India, Pakistan, particularly, have been able to come into townships across the country and do business quite well. You know, they're known for their business skills, and most of their spaza shops often are more competitive than the local ones, which studies say have shorter hours and don't have the network that some of these foreign business owners have in terms of getting stock and supplies. And they also don't have the capital. So I think there's a lot of resentment there from the business point of view in terms of that these guys can come in and they do work very well and they thrive. But there's also quite problematic issues in some of these spas or shops and things where you do have these foreigners who feel a little bit unwelcome or marginalized, and these locals who sort of want them to go. And so often you get little confrontations, and I even see it myself in my own local areas, where you sort of, there's quite a sort of dicey relationship between, particularly sort of black Africans mm-hmm. and these sort of often people from around the Indian area or Somalia, where they insult each other using racial slurs and things mm-hmm. like that, and they're very confrontational against each other. And so there's that as well. But then at the same time, of course, we can't ignore just the general underlying causes in South Africa that really do fuel a lot of this stuff. We've seen a lot of these incidents. It really is being pushed by the youth, all this looting across Soweto and how it's spread in some other areas now. The police have even said that some days were calm until school went out. So when school went out, that's when looting really picked up. So it's actually, a lot of this stuff is being pushed by school children and some adults, of course. But from that, I think we see that, number one, you've got young people who are always going to get involved in stupid sort of things. But I think it's the joblessness, youth unemployment, and then their parents are also suffering. So that sort of gives you some sort of motivation to steal, you know, to go and do something stupid and even potentially risk your life for, you know, for a few cold drinks and maybe airtime. The inequality that I think that we've seen across the country really does fuel a lot of this stuff. And it's disappointing because it goes back to a lot bigger questions in South Africa that no one has a easy answer to. But things like inequality, where people just have a perceived sense of injustice, especially when you're so close to someone who is doing well, when you yourself and your community are suffering. So I think there are a lot of these things as well. I think the xenophobic issue or what some people say is Afrophobic issue in South Africa runs so deep and it's so hard to explain.
Yeah, it does seem like there's a big element of this stems from the frustration that the youth are feeling, and this is an outlet for that frustration and just happens to be an easy target in being able to point at foreigners and to say, well, you know, I'm sitting here without a job, I'm sitting here, you know, in poverty, you know, you come in and, you know, you're an easy target coming in as a foreigner who is doing well or better than most people in those surroundings, and they just become this channel a way for them to channel their frustrations onto someone like that.
Most definitely. And I think it's really disappointing, but it's also like we've seen in service delivery projects. You know, it doesn't quite make sense for communities that may lack, you know, proper water, housing, roads, electricity services, to then take to the streets, particularly often these things are led by young people, to take to the streets and damage, you know, their traffic lights, their libraries, their community halls, their clinics, shut down the whole community so nobody can go to work at all, which you imagine further entrenches the suffering that they face. But it's just one more manifestation of these frustrations that I think have been building up over the years, particularly sort of after now we've passed 20 years of democratic South Africa, that build up more and more, and they will sometimes spill over. And in this case, when they've built over, the target point for the frustration has been foreign nationals. But I think also we have to talk about one other thing that I think the government has also do a little bit better in terms of, number one, registering these businesses. Some of the police told me that a lot of these businesses aren't registered. It's very hard to actually, if you want to protect them, it's very hard to actually find them until they're being attacked. Number two, make sure that the foreign and nationals are proper documented and they have the proper papers. And also make sure, try and avoid the problem that we've seen of unlicensed firearms being used by some of these foreign store owners because they are so scared. So I think there's also that dynamic added to the mix.
Greg, just going back to that point on an outlet of frustration for the youth, it's been interesting for me to see a country like Greece, who in the last 10 years has gone through some very difficult economic times and challenges over there. And what we're seeing now as a result of the implosion of that economy is that a third of the people are now living in poverty in Greece. And what we've seen there as well, and a lot of similarities, where people are lashing out at foreigners A lot of anti-Semitism is rising. Sentiment is rising up in Greece. People are lashing out at migrant workers from places like Albania, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, moving on to homophobic violence and anti-homophobic sentiment as well, rising there as well. So we're seeing a direct link coming through. Over and over again, that youth unemployment, that poverty, that poor economic circumstances, are kind of the base reason for a lot of this, violence. And it's not just in South Africa or on the African continent that we're experiencing this. We're seeing this happening in places like Greece and probably other places in Europe where those economic challenges are starting to become almost, you don't want to use the word, but Africa-like in terms of, the pervasiveness of the population that is feeling those economic challenges.
Mm-hmm. I think it is interesting. I think it is a global phenomenon that is experienced and manifests itself in different ways, throughout different parts of the world. But I think in many parts of the world, what we're seeing now is we're seeing rising inequality. We've seen a very, very uncertain times, both politically and economically, and particularly slow growth. So since, 2008, we've around much of the world have been struggling to sort of bounce back from the global financial crisis, and there has been a bit of a resetting of different institutions and different economic policies around the world. But we haven't even seen any sort of rapid, huge growth, maybe a bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. But then I think what generally happens with people, and this is sort of a broad generalization, of course, but what I think often happens when people are going through these difficult circumstances and perceive that they deserve and want better, they often find ways to I guess lash out or to express their disgruntlement and anger in any sort of way they can. And if you're just an average citizen on the street and someone who's sort of suffering from things like inequality, poverty, lack of education, joblessness, it's not easy to, access a minister or the president or even know how to speak to the government or use correct democratic channels, even if there are such channels to give you a voice. And so I think what often happens is you end up protesting or you end up taking it out on sort of minorities who are an easy sort of target to lay blame on. But I also think what it's a sign of too is it's our increasingly globalized world. We have so many people sort of traveling around the world, moving for different economic opportunities or migrating for whatever other reasons. And in this world today, I think more people are migrating and living in different spaces and working in different places than we've ever seen before. So there really is a prominent sort of migrant community in most countries now. For these targeted attacks to sort of happen and sort of like a confrontation, I think, of both sort of stronger nationalism that often increases in sort of difficult times, clashing with the globalized world.
Greg, how do we fix this? What do we do? What do we need to do? Do we need community leaders to get involved here, to embark on a Not In My Name campaign? Do we need the South African Police Service to get more involved? I mean, not exactly an organization that covers itself in glory in the last couple of years in dealing with the public in South Africa on many levels. But in your estimation, where do we start? How do we fix this problem from a South African perspective?
I think, you mentioned sort of community leaders and leaders sort of embarking on a Not In My Name campaign, and we have seen that a little bit in the last week. It took a few days, but I think these attacks sort of started on Monday. I think by Friday, we had a statement sort of from the president, not a very strong statement, but also Premier David Makura was in some of these affected areas and sort of saying that, this must stop. We saw Gauteng MEC also sort of take a strong position on this, as well as a few church leaders and community leaders. And I think that has actually helped really stem this continuing. So I think these things do work. If community leaders stand up and say, no, we cannot allow this to happen, but they must. I think that will help, but they must be very proactive in doing this. We can't wait for these situations to happen again. We can't wait till stores are being attacked or people are being violated in the streets. We have to have this sort of as a continuing dialogue and debate. And then if anything does ever flare up, we need community leaders to announce these actions. But I think we must also take this to the local level, because such anti-foreigner sentiment or xenophobia, if you will, particularly expresses itself, you know, in the townships and in local communities. And we need councillors and we need mayors and we need ward councillors to be saying this all the time to their communities, because often, because this is largely a community sort of often, this often anti-foreign and foreigner sentiment is very much community help, and so we need leaders at that community level to really denounce it and to really speak out against it. In the long term, I think it's a little bit more difficult to challenge, but it's a hard one. I think we must just continue to focus on economic growth, increase a better education, more job opportunities, really confronting the inequalities that we face, even if it's just speaking about it now and hopefully doing something about it in the future. So there's no easy long-term solution, but I think also in the short term, we do need a better police response. I'm not sure if you saw, but this week there were some reports of police actually being involved in the looting and encouraging looting. So I think that was really disappointing. The police are outnumbered in these sort of things, and often they are out-strategized, I guess. The community can easily move. The police arrive at one barber shop. The cops can, you know...
So if you can't beat them, join them. Is that what they...
Basically. And, you know, it's not bad if you're a cop on duty and you get a few free cold drinks and, you know, 29 round protocol or something like that, I guess. So that was also, I think, really disappointing, which is the last sort of thing we needed. And from what the police say, it does seem like sort of rotten elements in the cops, but still seems like those rotten elements are too pervasive.
And so many issues at the macro level as well that we need to tackle in order to fix these things, not just down at the local level. I mean, obviously, as you say, we need economic growth, we need job growth, we need opportunities, and those things aren't always going to be helped along by things like power cuts, for example, and load shedding, as well as, you know, the other economic challenges and poor growth that South Africa faces. Greg, thanks for joining us today, and hopefully we won't need to see you down in Soweto again anytime soon for stories like these.
Thanks, Billy. Have a great day. Thanks for having me.
All right. Cheers, Greg. On the line from Cape Town, we've got Daily Maverick sport writer Antoinette Miller. Ant, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So pretty big game for Bafana tonight. Need a bit of a miracle for things to go their way to progress to the next round. Do you see it happening?
To be honest, I don't see it happening. I think if I was an eternal optimist and perhaps one of those with trust and shakes fans, then yes, I would probably see that, you know, just that magic about him and everything like that. But unfortunately, I'm objective and quite cynical, so I don't see it happening.
I mean, this has been the pool of death, you know, looking at the teams, Ghana, Algeria, and Senegal, who are all top-rated teams in Africa. So it was always going to be a hard task, but, you know, the team did go into the tournament with a lot of, with a couple of good results under the belt and a lot of optimism. You know, in all likelihood, probably going to get knocked out tonight. Will they look back and say this was another failure of an attempt at AFCON, or has the team turned the corner? Have you seen you know enough improvement in that to say, you know, we're on the right track here?
Yeah, I don't think it'll be a failure at all. I mean, considering that before Shakes took over, South Africa weren't even expected to qualify for the Africa Cup of Nations, and they managed to qualify unbeaten in the group, in a group that has Nigeria, the defending champions, in it. I think they'll be disappointed, because so many of the results that didn't go their way was because of little things that they just didn't get right. But definitely not a failure. And I think also Wayne Mashaba is building the team, using youth and relying on youth and home-based players. That's a positive step, because Safa are leaving him to do what he wants. And he wants to use the guys who play the soccer motor in South Africa, and he wants to use the younger guys who don't have much experience to build towards, you know, the next World Cup and the next tournament. So getting knocked out tonight, no, and definitely not a failure.
A couple of selection question marks. A third goalkeeper in third game in the AFCON. There have been a couple of selection issues. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. And also, he only picked two centre-backs, like two centre-backs in the entire squad, I think. But again, it's one of those things, I suppose, he's new and he's not new, but he's new in the role, and he also perhaps wanted to prove a point in terms of relying on what his mind tells him and not what anyone else tells him. So, yeah, a bit stubbornness from him, but that's the way he's always been, and it was probably the way he was fired the last time he had a stint in charge of South Africa.
Yeah, and Parker again on the bench for this evening's game.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit strange, and especially the way he dropped Darren Keith after he saw Howler in the first match and selected another fresh goalkeeper, but he kept on persisting with Bekele Rantu, who hasn't really showed much in front of goal. He's very frustrating. So, you know, it's not even muchness, really. Both positives and negatives, but overwhelmingly positives, I think.
Who've been the teams that have impressed you? Who's looking like a winner at this stage?
It's been difficult, you know. It's one of those tournaments, and this is going to sound so cliche, but anyone can still win it, because at the start of the tournament, I'd have said Algeria, without a doubt, will win it, and they'll run away with it. But they haven't been that convincing, and they certainly haven't been as convincing as they were at the World Cup. So who's impressed me the most? I don't know. I like the way Senegal have played. They're very physical. They're very attacking. But to pick a winner at this stage, it's impossible. Flip a coin or, you know, throw a Rubik's Cube in there and pick a winner from there.
And if history is anything to go by, form going into the competition hasn't exactly been a good indicator of the eventual winners of the competition. We have seen some, you know, surprise dark horses coming from, you know, from left field and winning in the past. So, wouldn't be a surprise to see maybe some of the unfavored or, you know, lesser known teams ending up lifting the trophy at the end of the tournament. And coming up in a couple of weeks' time, you must be salivating at the prospect of the Cricket World Cup.
I'm not so much celebrating at the hours that will involve watching the Cricket World Cup, but of course, they're always exciting, and I think by the time it kicks off, you've got so much adrenaline from being awake for about 24 hours straight if there's a game on at 3 o'clock that just fuels your desire to keep on watching cricket.
Yeah, the times are going to be all over the show, mostly late at night, and this is really where students or parents with young kids don't take advantage of their nocturnal habits. This seems like, you know, another case of the best team South Africa has ever sent to a World Cup yet again. Obviously, going to a place that's not on the subcontinent, the World Cup being held in Australia and New Zealand, a place where South Africa have done really well touring in the last couple of years. Do you share the sentiment this is the best team and possibly our best chance of lifting the cup?
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange thing. People keep saying, oh, this is the best chance South Africa ever had of winning silverware. I mean, it's strange, like, that's sort of a testament to just how much cricket and talent South Africa produces all the time, but on paper, yes, Tashimamla, A.B. de Villiers, Quinton de Kock, Val Steyn, Morne Morkel, Vernon Philander, that probably is the best team they have. And like you mentioned, the conditions will play a massive role because it is also conditions that are much more similar to South Africa compared to subcontinental stuff where they have struggled in the past.
We're looking at, I think, the first big game, big test in our pool is coming up against India. India haven't had the greatest of series down under at the moment. They seem to be struggling a bit down in Australia. But when the World Cup comes around, all that goes out the window.
Yeah, of course it does. But I think also South Africa on a really good run of momentum, and all the players are sort of hitting form at the right time. I know it's just the West Indies that they're playing at the moment. But I think guys like David Miller finally showing that he can get those big scores, and he doesn't just carelessly throw his wicket away. All those sorts of things are counting in their favour. I don't know. It's one of those weird things where India also have some superb players on their side at the moment, but it's just about South Africa, I guess, staying calm and staying cool and just chilling and just knowing that this is the stage. And if somebody does fail at top of the order, they do have the talent lower down to back them up.
We can't mention the World Cup without mentioning the C word. Choking. And looking at this squad, you know, it's something that every captain will have to deal with until we win one of these damn things and put that to rest and get that monkey off our back as a cricketing nation. How do you think the guys will deal with that? I mean, I'm pretty sure AB de Villiers won't be able to go to a single conference without being asked about that and being asked repeatedly about that. How do the guys deal with that in the run-up to this tournament, and then once they're in the tournament and hopefully looking to progress into the knockout stages?
Yeah, it's sort of something that's under Gary Kirsten and still with them to make peace with the fact that, yes, they have choked in the past, and people will keep calling them chokers even if they don't choke. They just lose in a knockout match. Interestingly, they're not taking a psychologist, Paddy Upton, with them to the tournament. So I think to an extent maybe they've sort of deal with it on their own and within the team environment itself, saying, look, guys, this is what we get called. This is what happens. And it's about when they step onto the field in the knockout match, if they make it thus far, to put that aside and to say, look, whatever happens in the media, we'll deal with that afterwards. Right now, when we walk out there, let's just do what we've practiced and what we've perfected over the last 2 months in the build-up to this tournament.
Who are the danger teams? Who are the guys we need to watch out for when we get to hopefully get to the knockout stages?
New Zealand, definitely. Big threat. And this is a bit of a wild card, but Ireland are one of those strange teams that can do, that can beat any team on their day. And then I'm not only saying this with my vested interest in the country, but England have seemed to turn the corner themselves somewhat. And I think they might surprise people, if people don't take them seriously. And of course, Australia. You can never underestimate Australia in Australia. And with the guy, Mr. Steve Smith, who is just, I don't know what's happened to him or how he's suddenly become a
demigod.
Competitive cricketer. then there's him too. So
yeah, I was reading an interesting article in the Sydney Morning Herald about the fight basically that Michael Clarke has been having with administrators and bosses of Cricket Australia, and how the team is now starting to revel under not having him around and not having his, you know, his influence in the team, and obviously a very different approach from someone like Steve Smith, who by all accounts seems to be a lot more easygoing than Michael Clarke, and could be work in Australia's favour, you know, should he be declared unfit to play for the World Cup.
I've actually just read that article too, and I thought it was very interesting. But yeah, like you said, it's amazing what a difference just taking on one sort of negative, I don't want to call it negative influence, because Clark has been sold on the whole for youth thing happens. He can be very calming and very statesmanlike, but how taking away that headmaster kind of approach can change a team's approach completely. And I think Steve Smith has done that, because he's transformed himself over the last 2 years or over the last year or so into something quite extraordinary that nobody sort of expected him to do. So, yeah, I mean, I think they're a big threat, but hopefully if South Africa do have to play them, it doesn't happen until the final.
Yeah, and then hopefully we crush them on home ground to make up for that 99 semi-final. And you mentioned England. They'll be going there sort of without much fanfare. I mean, there'll always be the people at home, you know, saying the cup's coming home and all that, and those ardent supporters, like maybe one in the living room next to you at the moment. But they're going there without Kevin Peterson. Good thing or bad thing, are England's chances better for it or worse off for no Kevin Peterson in that World Cup squad?
Yeah, again, like you said, it's amazing what a difference just removing that one influence in a team can make. And talented as KP is, I think he's showed since the start of his career that no matter where he goes, KP's always going to have issues with someone. It could be the kit person or the captain of the team. KP's personality is just volatile, and it's going to clash with someone at some point during some form of competition. So I think, you know, in the greater scheme of things, not having him there probably is a good thing just from a team role perspective. But of course, you know, he is extremely talented. So from that aspect, yeah, they will miss him. But, you know, from a, like I said, a moral perspective, it's probably good that he's not there.
When you look at the South African team, you just see pluses and great players all around that starting 11. You've got a hugely talented top five, top six. You've got some incredible fast bowlers. We've got, for the first time, an attacking spinner. Is there an area you worry about that you think that's our weakness? That's the one area where teams will opponents will identify and look to challenge us on as soon as that opportunity arises?
Yeah, the death bowling, which has been an issue for ages. And it's weird that even with guys like us playing the morning, more calling the team, they still struggle to get it right at the death. And I think the average run to us have conceded in the last five overs over the last 6 months or so has been close to 60, 70 almost every single time. So for me, getting the death bowling right, and that's something they haven't really been able to practice against the West Indies because they've just collapsed. And then in the ODI that just happened, we saw again that when the backup bowlers came in, they had no answers for bowling at the death, and Andre Russell, brilliant as he was, took advantage of not really having plans or not using his strategy properly. So for me, the death bowling definitely a big concern. And then the tail is quite long. I mean, they only backed up to JP Duminy, really. So it's just there's no real solid all-rounder in the squad. I think on the rare day that everyone fails, they might find themselves in a bit of trouble with the batting because these days you want to score more than 300 to be sure that you're going to win an ODI. And the batting might just be a little bit thin if there's a major collapse or some bowler from the opposition has a brilliant day.
Well, that was quite an interesting stat. I think South Africa have the best record since 2013 of any team when batting first, posting more than 250. They've won, I think, 13 out of 17 games where that scenario has come up. So do you think that'll be the strategy for them going forward in the World Cup is bat first, get the top six to put on some big runs, and then, you know, take early wickets to put the side under massive pressure batting second?
Yeah, definitely, because like I mentioned before, that's because their batting lineup is so strong, they have to rely on them. And it was last year where I can't remember the exact stats, but South Africa's chasing record was absolutely horrible. And then during the tri-series in Zim last year, they sort of tested themselves batting second a bit just to make sure. But yeah, if they win the toss, I think 9 out of 10 times they're going to choose to bat first, just because, I mean, if you've got a top six like that, who wouldn't bat first?
What about the all-rounder position? I mean, that there was obviously some, you know, murmurings, or I wouldn't say controversy, but, you know, someone like a Ryan McLaren must have felt extremely hard done by not to have been selected for this World Cup.
Yeah, I think Ryan McLaren can feel more aggrieved from a purely bowling perspective. He was South Africa's best bowler for 2013, always taking wickets, always up there in the averages. Don't think he proved himself enough as a batsman, and especially when they went to Australia last year for that 5-match series, he had a terrible time, and that was probably that was probably his best now, really, that, you know, ended up with him being on the sidelines or out of the squad completely.
Okay, so we need to pick one star. Who's going to win this World Cup for us? Who's going to be, when we look back once the tournament is done and dusted and there's a ticker tape parade through the cities of South Africa with AB de Villiers lofting that trophy for us to see, who in your estimation is going to be that person we're going to look back and say, this was our man of the tournament? This is the person who finally brought this cup home to us.
Yeah, I think it's going to be AB de Villiers. I mean, the form that he's in at the moment, the form he has been in, is just, it's on another level to any other person. I doubt that he's even human, to be honest. He's a freak. And I think if you have a player like that in your team who can adapt to any situation, who can play in any situation, who can do something incredible as hitting 100 or 31 balls in a day, then you're pretty settled, and he's going to be your key man.
How do we use him? How do we get the best out of AB de Villiers? Where do you bat him in the lineup? Do you approach it from X number of overs left? That's when you send him in.
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, most people would say he should be opening because he is the best batsman and he should bat as many overs as possible. But with the way cricket is modernised, I don't think that's always necessary. Because with the two new balls, you can get Umler and the Cox to sort of take the shine off a little bit, and then De Villiers can come in here a bit faster and it's coming onto the bat a bit easier. So I think they should just box kid and they should do what they did at the Wanderers. De Villiers wasn't meant to go in where he did, but then Domingo sort of insisted, yes, please go in. And I think it's sort of just reading the situation on the day. If they lose quick wickets early, then send in someone like De Villiers who can both adapt and slow things down. And if they sets a solid foundation and then bring him in lower down the order so he can have a blitz where David Miller, who has struggled to be that finisher, is perhaps not under so much pressure. So, again, it's one of those depends on the situation, depends on the day kind of thing.
And do you think we can do it? Are we coming home with the cup?
No, I don't think so. I think Australia for me, just because of, you know, the whole revival they've had under Smith. But although I'm sure people would want to say yes, and I think in their heart they probably think yes, but I think we can do it. I don't know.
Why? Why are you just hoping not to jinx it? Or you know, what do you think? What's going to be the thing that holds us back?
I just think mentally it might just be another slip up again. Maybe that's because of years and years of ingrained trauma that's been forced in my head, especially the 1999 edition that never actually happened. But yeah, I don't know. I'm just a bit, just mentally for me, I'm a slightly worried, and of course. The death bowling for me is a big issue. They brought Shaw Langerfeld in to try and remedy them, you know, varying their lengths and bowling some more Yorkers, but I haven't really seen any of that. So, yeah, for me, that death bowling and the mental preparation is somewhat concerning.
Well, I have no qualms about saying that I think we're going to do it this time, regardless of the emotional scars and trauma that we've had to endure since 1992, and having, you know, a run of bad luck has to come to an end. I think that, you know, the squad is, you know, fresh enough and new enough. We don't have, you know, a lot of that baggage. You know, we might say that, you know, we even choked in the last one, but, you know, were we ever really in a position where we were ahead to throw that game away? You know, which belies the definition of choking. So I'm hoping we'll do it. I'm hoping we can stuff it to the Aussies in a final. That would be great. That would be a great way of doing it. And, you know, it's also one of those things I have in the back of my mind is like, when a legend like Jacques Callis, who's been almost carrying a nation for his entire career, retires, and then the team goes on to win, and then you can point to him and say he was holding us back, it would also be quite ironic and quite funny. But I'm quietly optimistic. I'm hoping for a Proteas and Springbok double this year. I said that in 99, and geez, we had two of the most incredibly unlucky and ways of being eliminated from both of those World Cups. So I'm hoping I'm not jinxing it again. And it's going to be a riveting tournament either way.
Do you think Suffering can make it through to AFCON course finals thing?
Fine, all the way, and I'm backing the guys all the way. It's I've got no doubt it'll happen this time. I'm even going to put money on it.
Okay, well, you can drink
me
the Kool-Aid.
And thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking World Cup and AFCON with you. And I hope we'll have this conversation in the not too distant future, where you can apologize for your predictions.
I will. Okay, thank you so much.
Cheers, Ant. Thanks. Well, that was the Daily Maverick show. It's very likely the last one that I'll be hosting, unless I get a special guest appearance. To all those who've been listening and downloading the podcast, it's been a great experience launching this on Cliff Central with the Daily Maverick team. We'll have the show will continue. There will be various journos hosting in rotation until we find a permanent replacement. But till then, till the next time, to all the fans and the listeners, it's been great.